You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 25th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello.
Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
Jay Novella.
Hello, Governor.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, and happy DNA Day to everyone.
DNA Day.
The double helix thing?
Douglas Adams?
Celebrates the completion of the Human Genome Project and the discovery of the double helix.
Hey, but Evan, isn't today Secretary's Day or something?
Yeah, it's Admin Day, I think.
Wait a minute. Perry got it right. Double helix. Thank you.
The Skeptic's Guide has tipped over a completely arbitrary and random milestone that we are now going to commemorate. Mm-hmm. We have surpassed 1 million downloads of our podcast.
1 million downloads.
Did anybody bring champagne?
I started an hour ago.
So, Steve, our listeners want to know, what does this mean?
Means that our bloviating has penetrated the deepest recesses of the human mind. That's what it means.
Actually, we've been anticipating this because we could see the tickers going up on the site that hosts the files, our media server. And I was actually surprised that in the last week, even though we're getting about 16,000 to 17,000 downloads per episode, we had about 30,000 downloads total last week, which means for everyone who's downloading the latest episode, they're also downloading an older episode.
That's good.
Yeah, people go back to the library. That's why we put it up there.
So just to, you know, thanks again to all of our listeners for making our podcast a success. And it's nice. You know, a million downloads has a sort of a psychological ring to it. Another little follow-up from last week. At the end of the last episode, I mentioned that I was going to be on the Infidel Guys, the Debate Hour, and that was recorded on Friday. It's now available as a podcast, and I'll have the link so you can download that. I debated Dr. Fred Bowman, who is also a neurologist, and he has written books and many articles and has a website basically saying that all of modern psychiatry is a fraud, that mental illnesses like ADHD do not exist, they're not real, and that it's all a big conspiracy of the pharmaceutical industry. So actually, I think the debate went pretty well.
It did. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it's always hard to engage these people in debate. It's a lot easier always to do the other side. You know, for example, he said some things that were just factually incorrect. So if you make stuff up, it's kind of really easy to score points in a debate. One of the biggest factual disagreements between us is he kept on saying that there was no evidence for biological abnormalities in the brains of people with, like, say, schizophrenia or ADHD. And there is. I mean, there was, you know, copious amounts of published studies, and he just kept insisting that there wasn't. I'm like, Fred, I'm looking at it right now. It's right in front of me. You know, I told people how to go to PubMed, look up ADHD and medication naive, and you'll be looking at the same 23 articles I'm looking at. But it's hard, you know, in an audible debate, it's hard to come across with those kind of facts like that. So this week on my blog, I actually digested and reanalyzed the debate and writing like a 4-part blog about mental illness denial and covering all the topics that he brought up, including links to, you know, the published studies that I was referring to during the debate. So if you listen to the debate, and if you're interested in that topic, you'll get into a lot deeper by reading my blog entries from this week.
Well, I may be prejudiced, you know. I think you crushed him in the debate.
I did get him good with the migraine comment. That was a good point.
He was stumbling and mumbling.
That was my best and his worst moment, because, you know, essentially a migraine headache syndrome is a perfect analog of like ADHD or schizophrenia, in that it's a disorder. It occurs in the brain. Its symptoms are completely subjective. There's no diagnostic test for it. It's diagnosed clinically. So all of the things that Dr. Bowman and others like him used to say that mental illnesses aren't real are true about migraines. So if you think that ADHD isn't real, you should also think that migraines are not real, basically. And when I asked him if he ever diagnosed anybody with a migraine, he did fumble. He knew exactly what I was getting at when I said that question. I had him, and he knew I had him, and he was grasping. And what he grasped for was totally bogus. He said that patients with migraine have a scotoma, which means they have like a dark spot, a loss of vision in their visual field, and that's an objective finding, and that's why it's different. It's like, well, only a subset of patients with migraine have that. Many migraine patients don't have that. And having a scotoma, in fact, having any abnormalities on the neurological exam are not required for the diagnosis. They're not even on the list. If you look at the list of symptoms that you need to have a migraine, this is the International Headache Classification Criteria for migraine, don't include scotoma as a component at all, let alone being necessary. So I guess Dr. Bowman has his own personal criteria for diagnosing migraine that differ from the rest of the world in neurology. But he threw that out there as if it, to rescue himself, as if it made his point. And that was totally intellectually dishonest to do that, because he knows that that was total BS. He's got to know, being a neurologist, that that was completely BS.
And Steve, he also, at one point, he reminded me of evolution deniers, in that he kept repeating over and over, what's the one study? Give me the one study that shows that there's some sort of pathology there. And it's not that clear cut. You have to take the whole gestalt. You can't take apart evolution. You know, you can't prove evolution with one definitive study. But when you take it all together, damn, it's there. There's no denying it.
Yeah, it is a denial syndrome. It is like denying evolution, or denying HIV causes AIDS, or denying the Holocaust. They use the same intellectual strategies. It's very, very similar.
Would you call it a disorder?
I would call it it's like, you know, it's a subset of pseudoscience. You know, denying a legitimate body of science is in and of itself a pseudoscience, and they used similar strategies. And you can, in fact, I wrote an article about it, just sort of comparing evolution denial to mental illness denial and Holocaust denial, and looked at the sort of the common threads among them. Let's go on to the next topic. There was a pretty interesting discovery made very recently.
This is great.
The most Earth-like planet to date has been discovered around a fairly close star. The newly discovered planet circles the star Gliese 581c, which is 20.5 light years away from the Earth.
It's close.
In the constellation Libra. It's very close. It's one of the closest stars to us. The planet was discovered using the techniques that they've been using, where they can look at the wobble in the star to say that there's got to be another object gravitationally affecting it, you know, revolving around it, namely a planet. Now, because you need planets that are fairly big and also fairly close to the star in order to cause it to wobble visibly, most of the planets that we've seen are actually fairly big. They're like bigger than Jupiter. They're gas giants. We've discovered 211 planets so far. This one, however, is the smallest planet. It's only about 1.5 times larger in diameter than the Earth, although it has about 5 times the mass of the Earth. And I think that works out, the article I'm reading on NASA says that works out to about twice at the surface, it would have about twice the gravity of the Earth. And they're not sure yet if it's a rocky planet or if it's made mostly of ice. If it's more, the more ice it is, then the bigger it would have to be in order to have that amount of mass.
And so if it was ice at one time, it probably would have melted now to be a planet-wide ocean. I mean, I don't think it would be an ice ball at this point if the temperature range is what they suspect.
And right, you bring up the other very interesting and exciting point about this world, is that it's in the so-called habitable zone.
The Goldilocks zone.
The Goldilocks zone, just right, where water, you could have theoretically have liquid water. You know, a lot of the news articles about it speculated about whether or not the planet would be habitable, and ask about what the effects would be of living on a planet with twice the gravity. Long term, you would have accelerated, you know, degenerative arthritis in your joints and your spine just from the extra wear and tear.
Yeah, long term, it probably wouldn't be pretty.
It would also be a good workout.
It'd be a good workout. You get pretty muscular, but you know, like if you're jet fighters routinely undergo 3, 4, 5 Gs, so it's
you'd have evolved. No, you'd have evolved to be a creature suitable to that.
Well, yeah.
I think he's thinking if we blasted off and made a
colonize the world.
I read a 150-pound person, which is, say, roughly my weight, would be 240 pounds. I could walk around if I weighed 240. I wouldn't be completely debilitated.
It would probably put extra stress on everything, and you'd probably have a shorter lifespan. So.
Yeah. Now, it's worth pointing out that we can't see the planet directly. It even being as close as it is, it's too close to its sun for us to separate the two out visually. So we've only detected it by its effect on the on its star, that you know, 20.5 light years away is still far away. So we don't even know how we could potentially even get there. You know, it's certainly not going to happen anytime soon. This may be something that happens in hundreds or more, you know, years. We don't have to worry about contaminating that planet for a while. But it does bring up the speculation that, hey, this is a planet that has liquid water. Maybe it could be inhabited by life. But that is, you know, it's certainly very interesting, and a lot of the news reports took that angle. But that's totally speculative, and it's far too early to even think about there being life on that planet.
You know, what I'm excited about is when we eventually get some of the next generation, you know, Hubbles out there, where we can actually discern some really interesting information about the planet rather than just, you know, wobbling wavelengths. There were a couple other really interesting things about this. The fact that, first off, this was very close to the time where we could, this is like the first time we could really make out, you know, Earth-sized planets. And very soon after we have that capability, bam, we find one. So that,
yes,
that bodes well for other other Earth-like planets out there. Secondly, up until recently, we never really thought that red dwarfs could have planets around them for whatever reason. And now we found one. We found a red dwarf with a planet around it like Earth. And I think in at least near Earth, 80% of the stars are red dwarfs. Many of them are red dwarfs. So that bodes very well for...
Yeah, so this expands...
The red dwarf was going to absorb those planets? Is that why you don't find the small planets close to the red dwarf?
They're bigger, dimmer stars. So they didn't think that they would be good candidate stars to have Earth-like planets around them. But this expands the number of stars that we think are good candidate stars to look at. And you're right, Bob. You know, we're basically finding planets wherever we look. So very, very quickly. So that does make it seem as if most stars are going to have planets around them. And it's one piece of that Drake equation, right? The Drake equation basically calculating the probability of spacefaring or radio transmitting technological civilizations, you know, in our galaxy and outside the galaxy. And, you know, one of the assumptions in that calculation is how many star systems have planets around them, and on average, how many planets do they have, and, you know, how many of those planets can have life. We didn't know the answer to that. And some people say, well, maybe our configuration is very, very, very rare. Maybe most stars do not have rocky, habitable planets around them. And that would throw the Drake equation off. I mean, that would drastically reduce the number of civilizations that statistically should be out there. So this addresses that one component. There seems to be a lot of planets and probably a lot of Earth-like planets out there.
Does this mean we're going to start taking a look at closer stars, closer systems as well, again, to look for these planets?
Now, I don't know how they're choosing which stars to look at right now, so I don't know the answer to that. It makes you wonder what that, you know, red dwarf sun would look like from the surface of that planet.
Well, it'd be red, you know, of course, but it would more importantly, it would be I think it's like 15 times the apparent size of the moon. So the view would be amazing on that planet. Imagine how that would look. Now something occurred to me. This planet apparently is 7 million miles away from its star. The Earth is 93 million miles away. So I kind of did a back of the envelope calculation. What would the tidal forces be on this planet? Now, tidal forces is related to gravity, but it mainly refers to the difference in gravity from the near side of an object to the far side. The closer the near side of the Earth has more of a gravitational pull, or the moon has more of a gravitational pull than the far side. So that disparity causes the tide. So I wanted to figure out, all right, what would the tides be like on a planet that close to a star? So let me just quickly go through my calculations. We got a lot of bright people listening. Maybe I'm making some sort of egregious error, but I don't think so. Let's see. Tidal forces drop with a cube of the distance. So if the planet is 13.3 times closer to its sun, then the tidal forces would be 13 times 13 times 13, which would be 2,200 times that of the sun on the Earth. But since the planet has, since the star, Gliese 5, was it 561, the star has one-third the mass of the sun, that's 2,200 times 0.3, so it's 726 times the tidal effect on the planet that the sun has on the Earth. But there's one other thing to account for. The sun accounts for only 33% of the total tidal force acting on the Earth, the Sun, the Moon, of course, accounting for the other 66%. So that would be 726 times 0.3. So 240. I came out with the star Gliese 561 has 240 times the tidal force acting on it that the Sun Moon has on the Earth. So 240. Imagine the tides on the Earth being 240 times as intense as they are.
Yeah.
That's pretty gargantuan, and the effect might even be magnified a little bit because the diameter of the planet is bigger than the Earth.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And I'm not sure what the actual mass of the planet might also have an effect either way, but still, I don't think I'm off by anything like an order of magnitude. So over 240 times, that could increase volcanism so much that might totally prevent any life from being on. It might just be volcanoes erupting 24 hours a day all over the place.
Well, it could be entirely covered by an ocean for all we know. And actually, Phil Plait on his Bad Astronomy blog talks about this. He postulates about the fact that the planet may be tidally locked, saying that one side is always facing the sun,
right.
And how that would affect it. So, like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff we don't know.
Like the moon is tidally locked to the Earth, and eventually, in many millions of years, the Earth will be tidally locked to the moon, so that eventually only one side of the Earth will forever face the moon. But I'm not sure tidal locking will have that much effect on life. It wouldn't prevent, I don't think, life developing on it, but I think these tidal forces could. And even if it was a planet-wide ocean, if you've got tremendous tidal forces, that increased heat could potentially just boil away the ocean. I mean, look at some of the moons of Jupiter. The tidal forces are so gargantuan because they're orbiting such a massive planet that some of the moons of Jupiter are just volcanoes going off.
Well, Io is basically constantly turning itself inside out with volcanism.
And it's all because, I mean, there's no real, radioactive decay going on in the center of that moon. It's just all the tidal forces is what's causing the friction and the heat and just turning itself inside out. So it's just an interesting aside.
You think that this planet is also in the vicious grip of global warming like we are?
If it is, it's not human caused. That's for sure.
It's good to know.
Well, but it is very neat to now be able to speculate about what these extrasolar planets are like. You know, we actually have some facts where we could start to think about what an actual planet outside of our solar system could be like, given what we know about it. And we're just going to learn more and more. So it's pretty cool.
The universe is pretty big. You know, it's pretty big. There's probably a lot of Class M planets out there.
I'm sure this shows it. Christ, we got one 20 light years away.
That planet with the Nazis running around, that's a Class M planet.
It's a bad place.
one more news item. This is also a very, very cool science news item from this week. This one dealing with medicine. The title of this article is Daily Pill to Beat Genetic Diseases. Now, when I first saw this, this is like the kind of claim that immediately made me skeptical, for lack of a better word. That if you said, hey, you could take a pharmaceutical, a drug that would basically cure hundreds of different genetic diseases. When I first saw that, I just could not think of what the mechanism would be. Nothing really occurred to me. Like, how could that possibly work? How could you cure so many different genetic diseases with a drug? I just didn't get it. But this is legitimate. This is cool. So this is the drug known as PTC-124, and this is designed to treat a specific kind of genetic disease caused by a specific type of mutation called a nonsense mutation, which means that a gene is a sequence of base pairs on the DNA, and every three letters, equals one specific amino acid. And if a mutation that changes one of those three-letter codes to a combination that doesn't code for any amino acid is usually codes for what's called a stop codon, which basically tells the ribosome, which is the little factory inside each cell that makes proteins from the RNA, it tells the ribosome to stop there. So if you have a mutation in a gene that turns that three-letter code into a nonsense code, a stop code, that cuts off the production of the protein. So the entire protein doesn't get made. Only a small piece of the protein gets made. So those are bad mutations because the whole protein is defunct now. You don't make – so instead of having a protein with just like one amino acid out of order, you get just a small fraction of the protein that's completely non-functional. So for example, in Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, there's a protein. The protein's called dystrophin, named after the disease, actually, and that it's a very important structural protein in muscles. And in Duchenne's, there's a nonsense mutation so that the muscle cells do not make dystrophin at all, and therefore muscle tissue breaks down over time. This is very clever. What the drug is designed to do is it binds to the ribosome, again the factory that makes the proteins from the RNA, and it tells it to ignore the stop instructions. So it will make the entire gene, and it will bypass these mutated stop codons, which is very clever. I didn't realize that was possible, actually. And because that addresses a basic mechanism of that type of mutation, it doesn't matter what the disease is or what the mutation is. It will bypass that entire class of mutations, which means that there's about, I think they said there's 1,200 identified diseases where that is the type of mutation. So that's a lot of different diseases.
How
that
many?
Could potentially. Oh, 1,800? More than 1,800 genetic diseases.
Yeah, but Steve, when I read that 1,800, like, wow, that's a lot of genetic diseases. But then a few paragraphs down, I got a little bummed when it said, in most genetic conditions, between 5% and 15% of cases are caused by the nonsense mutations, and that seems pretty low. So does that mean I didn't know there were quite that many, you know, genetic illnesses, 1,800 times whatever, but 5 to 15% doesn't sound like much. Well, it says here that it should also work against more than 1,800 other genetic diseases.
Yeah.
That to me, that means there's 1,800 of these nonsense mutations, which are only 5 to 15% of all genetic defects. So, but still, that's a lot. 1,800 is gargantuan. Too bad it wasn't able to address more than, you know,
hey,
more
I mean,
percentage.
coming up with a drug that would cure just one of those diseases is huge.
Right.
You know, even just Duchenne's or cystic fibrosis, which are both target diseases. Now, before we get too excited, we have to say that this is in phase two trials right now. So there's in clinical trials, there's preclinical trials, which are like in the test tube and in animals, and then there's phase one human trials, which are just looking at safety in healthy individuals, and then phase two trials, which are looking more safety data, some pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics, and started to get some early indication if there's a beneficial effect. And then phase three are definitive, usually, you know, placebo-controlled trials where you want to definitively answer, does it work or not? And then phase four trials are after post-marketing, after-marketing trials. So phase two is preliminary. And then based upon the results of the phase two trials that are ongoing right now, you know, we'll decide if we go on to the phase three trials, if it's safe and has an indication of efficacy. So it's going to be years to figure out if these work. And they may not, you know, sometimes I've seen lots and lots of drugs crap out between phase two and phase three trials. So too early to celebrate now, but it's looking very hopeful.
I mean, how many diseases are they testing it against currently? And
the two that I've seen are cystic fibrosis and Duchenne's muscular dystrophy.
Well, say it's safe, but just not efficacious. But does that mean that, oh, well, we could try 1,798 other diseases to see if it works? I mean, of course, at some point you'd say, screw it. It doesn't work against, you know, any of these. But still, just because it failed on some, does that mean that it would necessarily fail on hundreds of others?
Based upon the basic science, that you know, how it's supposed to work, you would think it either works or it doesn't.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure why it would work for one and not for another. The animal data is very encouraging. In the mouse model of Duchenne's, in the animal studies, apparently the when they treated mice with Duchenne's, basically they started making dystrophin and repairing their muscle fibers and developed normal muscle. So if that doesn't happen in humans for some reason, then there's just something different, you know, about the human ribosome or whatever that's keeping it from working. And then they probably would still want to try it in a few more just to be sure. But I'm sure after a certain number of negative trials, it'll be hard to continue to press forward. Then they'd probably go back to the drawing board, tweak the chemical, do some more basic research, and before going back to human trials.
Steve, does that mean the people or the patients who would conceivably be taking these when it, if and when it reaches that point, they're going to have to be on these for the rest of their life to keep up with,
yes,
with that?
Exactly.
Right?
That's exactly that. Right. That's right. You take it every day.
Yeah.
Small price to pay.
Well, oh, yeah, for those diseases. For a lot of these diseases are bad. You know, when you, there's a critical protein you're not making at all, that's usually a bad thing. So you know, taking a pill a day is not a big deal. So this is the most surprising science news item I've heard in a long time, you know,
yeah,
especially within the field of medicine. This is, you know, really – it's very good news, and it's very surprising, and I hope it works out, you know. I've been at this point before with a lot of other things, and that have just did not work out. So you still have to be, you have to have cautious optimism at this point.
It's been quite a week. An Earth-like planet found, and this wonder drug.
Yeah, yeah. One quick follow-up from last week. Last week we talked about the European Union considering passing laws to criminalize Holocaust denial. And just the quick follow-up is that they've actually made their decision, and they did pass a law essentially criminalizing Holocaust denial. But in the process, the political process of passing the law, it got watered down to the point that it doesn't really have any teeth. So it's kind of a good news, bad news. They did pass the law, but it's, you know, it's basically toothless. So,
so it's what, ceremonial or symbolic more than anything?
Symbolic. So it's more symbolic than anything else. I still think the whole thing is a bad idea,
yeah,
to try to regulate.
Yeah,
what,
that's awful.
It's awful, but that's a sort of good outcome. The only thing is that it could set a precedent for more stringent laws to come down the road. So it's just a bad.
Yeah, I mean, look at some of the symbolic laws that we have, like, you know, well, until recently, how anal sex has been outlawed.
The sodomy
all across
laws,
the US,
yeah.
You know, sodomy laws. So, you know, just get rid of them.
Yeah.
It's kind of absurd.
I agree.
But anyway, we talked about it last week.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, that was just a quick follow up.
This is Adam Savage.
This is Tori Belacci.
We're the Mythbusters, and you're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Let's move on to your emails and questions. The first one comes from Dave, a.k.a. Orac. He's a fellow science blogger. And he writes, just listened to your podcast of 418 while working in my office. Great work, but I have a little nit to pick. The bacterial flagellum paper that you cited is apparently not so good and does not really show what it purports to show, thanks to problems using the BLAST algorithm. You may want to take a look at, and he gives several links. Well, I took a look at them. So just for a little background, last week we were talking about intelligent design in the context of my, this time a written debate with that neurosurgeon, Dr. Egnor, and we brought up the fact that there was this new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that purported to show the evolution of the bacterial flagellum by gene duplication. Was very apropos to the discussion. To put this into perspective, that, you know, the Proceedings is a very prestigious journal. So this is a, you know, presumably if a paper gets published in the Proceedings, it has passed a significant degree of peer review and editorial review. But in the week since, you know, we recorded last episode, you know, the scientific community has had a chance to read the article and to pick over it, which is the post-publication peer review process that occurs, and they're finding quite a few problems with it. So the paper is not as good as you might think. It gets very, very technical. I will have the links to the links that Dave provided were for another science blog called The Panda's Thumb by Nick Matsky. He wrote a series of entries giving his analysis of the paper, and he found some significant problems with their conclusions. Basically, this is what it comes down to. Yes, a number of the genes that make up the bacterial flagella do appear to have occurred, are related to each other. They did evolve through gene duplication, but not, as the paper claims, all of the genes that make up the flagellum. In fact, some of the other genes have traits in common with genes that are not part of the flagellum, and therefore they probably evolved from from those genes. None of this, of course, has anything to do with whether or not the bacterial flagellum evolved. It has nothing to do with the fact that gene duplication exists and that the flagellum evolved through gene duplication. It's just the specific interpretation of how the genes were related to each other and how they evolved over time. And that's in dispute. And this is exactly how science works. You know, these details are being picked over and will be debated. Now, of course, you know, this is what the creationists have been doing for decades, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the ideas do the same thing, where they take a debate about some of the details about how things evolved, and they turn that into disagreement about whether or not they did evolve. So, unfortunately, this whole incident is probably going to make hay, as Nick said, for the ideas, but it's actually a pretty typical story in science. Now that we have hundreds or thousands of people picking over this paper, the problems will be ferreted out. So that's science.
Well, now wait a minute, Steve. I heard
work.
A creationist correct himself about you know, actually, I think in the whole 6,000 year history of the Earth, I don't think a creationist has ever corrected himself about anything.
No, you're probably right. Right. That's exactly right. I mean, it's because creationism and intelligent design are not sciences. They do not.
I beg
to
differ. I believe that there was one doubting Thomas who changed his mind, and I'm pretty sure he was a creationist. QED Perry.
I stand corrected. See? I'm willing to admit it. Thank you.
It's big of you.
And it is.
It's also kind of fun being in the science blog community. Because the science blog community, I've had a lot of fun being involved with it in the last few months. I'm really glad I decided to write a blog, because it's kind of a vibrant sort
of
subcommunity.
How do you interface with science bloggers? What kind of communication?
Well, we all email each other. We all read each other's blogs. There's a skeptical carnival where we all sort of contribute to. Rebecca has been doing this even for longer than I have, you know, contribute to, like, every 2 weeks there's the skeptic circle, which is like 20 or so skeptical blog entries that all get linked to from one person's blog who's hosting it that
week.
Yeah,
and they all get around and they rub each other's backs and they talk about girls.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was at a humanist conference this weekend where I was on a panel for the next generation of humanism, and that a lot of the things we were talking about involved things like this, and that's what I spoke about at the Amazing meeting too, because I think it's so important. People don't understand until they really get into it how important the online community is. And so something like a blog, it's so easy to stay connected with people who have, you know, you have experts in every field you could hope for, and they're right at your fingertips, and everybody's interacting. It's a really great place to be, and it's a great place to hone your skeptical skills. So if anybody out there has a blog, you know, feel free to email Steve and me and guys through the site. You know, let us know your blog address, and we can all link, because it's a huge part of the community.
We'll give some link love.
Rebecca and Steve, you both run blogs. What's the difference between a blog community as opposed to the forum community, if any?
Well, the forum is basically anybody can sign up to the forum, and anybody can start new topics, and anybody can then respond to those topics. But on a blog, you've basically got one person, in Steve's case, or a small group of people, in Skeptic's case, who are posting regular essays, which tend to be a bit more thought out than, you know, a random forum post. Usually, you know, not always.
somewhere between a forum post and a full-fledged article.
Tagging on to those blog posts, anybody can come along and then comment on that blog topic, and then there can be a discussion on each blog topic. I think both forums and blogs are really important for encouraging community. And that's why, of course, we have both for Skeptic's Guide.
Absolutely. And you know what? This is one of those tangible examples of how the internet technology has actually accelerated the pace of science. Because here you have you know, this paper gets published. There's an online community. You could read it online even before it comes out in print. And before this thing is even out in print, it's been totally dissected by a lot of people. You can discuss it back and forth. You can argue back and forth. The transmission of information, the community effort.
Oh, yeah, the acceleration of information exchanges. It's phenomenal. It's mind-boggling.
It's incredible.
It really is.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it is. And this is a great example of it. The thing is not even in print yet, and already it's been dissected by the community.
Where does
great,
that leave fabulous. Print journals, though, Steve? You know, what's the guy who's...
They're struggling to figure out what their place is in all of this, you know, it's seriously. True. Although, luckily, people still like to read on the can. You know, having something tangible in your hand is still, there's still a niche for that.
Beautifully put.
I couldn't think of any other way to say it. That's what it comes down to.
Tight and you're like, you pull out a tube of toothpaste, you read that. Anything other than not reading.
Oh my God, it wasn't just me? Holy crap.
What is
crap.
With you guys? I've never read a single thing on the toilet.
You it's are not never? Human. How could you?
Wait a minute. Wait how? A minute.
No, I'm not a boy. This has got to be a guy thing. And okay, let's throw this out to the audience. Please, I have actually wondered about this. I'm pretty sure that this is just a guy thing. Girls, first of all, girls don't poop. But second of all,
besides Germany, they do,
that,
baby. Oh, yeah.
aside from that fact, girls just don't spend that much time on the toilet. I think we get in, we get it done, and then we get out. We spend all of our time in front of the
mirror.
Then
why do you go to the toilet in groups?
Because we have to talk. It's different. We talk. But we talk while we're doing our makeup.
It says you can cheer each other on. Go for that piss, baby. You look like a racehorse.
Just so we're clear, you just quoted Andrew Dice Clay.
Happens to be a brilliant man. But I want to just say,
wow.
I don't know about reading.
You're just getting on.
I hope you just lost a lot of fans there.
I am on the cutting edge. I have a television in my bathroom.
No,
you
don't.
Thank you very much.
Wow.
So when I sit on the can, I can get absorbed into a program. I could sit there for an hour.
I have a television.
You can't hear. I'm clapping. A TV in the bathroom. Holy
please
crap.
Tell
as you as I am, as incredible as that is, it's not good for the O-ring to sit on the can for more than like 5 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got to disagree.
That's Perry, you really are my... Perry, you are my exact opposite. In every way.
Sometimes I lounge in a tub for hours.
With
you know,
the meat
with a good
eating
movie
and
on.
The I don't even own a television. You have a television in your bathroom.
I've got five TVs in this house. Television's everywhere. God. You got to monitor what's going on, you know?
Perry and Rebecca like matter and antimatter. Is that what you're saying?
Right. We are. We can never be in the same room or the universe will collapse.
But you never got a marriage proposal from me.
That's true.
So there you go.
Well, it won't really collapse.
I'm not
You'll
complaining.
Just burst into a, you know, a bunch of gamma rays, but it's still nasty.
I urge everyone to get a TV for their can. Thank you.
Or a toilet for your computer.
Yeah, why not just install a toilet in your armchair, Perry?
Yeah. You could.
Don't give him any ideas. Don't give him any ideas.
Every day I take breath, I realize that you are more and more like Cartman.
That will make those.
I would never want to admit.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah,
know
I
if
think
he's
you're
got
right.
a TV in his bathroom. But
no, but if he grew up and were real, he would.
All right, listen, we have time for one more email. This one comes from Roy Huff, and Roy gives his location as the USA. And he writes, I am curious about the claims of the Alcor Life Extension Foundation being able to preserve bodies in a cold process without freezing called vitrification. This works without actually freezing at the cellular level. This apparently is already being used for their members, and they have over 80 members currently in stasis. Is this science or not? Their fact could be found at this link.
Sounds like
Here
the heavens,
we go.
Sounds like the Heaven's Gate people.
Here we go.
Jay?
Jay's a member.
Jay, now, I think we've talked about this. We've broached the subject slightly before. Haven't
so, Jay,
we?
Let us have it. Tell what's the skinny on vitrification?
Give it to us.
Okay, first of all, I am a member of Alcor. I joined on my 30th birthday. You know, before I did it, there was years and years of lead up. You know, I'd have to tell everyone right now, Bob is the reason why I even knew about it. Bob's the reason why I started reading about it. And Bob's the information first came from him. It piqued my curiosity. And the reason why I made the decision originally to do it, and it still stands today, but, you know, it struck me when I turned 30, I'm getting older.
And I wanted to do something, anything, other than just put myself into the ground. Even though I did a lot of research and I felt like there was enough going on there that it was worth doing, in my opinion, the science is sound. They are using a lot of current sciences that are used every day. You know, they're using chemicals that are used to suspend organs that are used for organ transplant. Alcor does a lot of its own research, but it also uses world research from all these other organizations all over the place. You know, they obviously can't do it all on their own, but there's a lot of other sciences that are going on that benefit Alcor and their cause. As far as vitrification is concerned, Alcor is using the vitrification process. It is an absolutely integrated part of the whole cryonics process. I mean, it's kind of hard to say that there's a difference between cryonics and vitrification at this point.
So they pickle you and then freeze you, Jay?
In short, the process is, this is a very abbreviated version of it, and you know, and I'm not an expert on this at all, but in short, what they do is when someone has is about to die or has died and they start the process, the first thing that they do is they inject you with anticoagulants. They continue your respiration and they lower your body temperature.
So you're still alive and they are beginning the freezing process.
No, today you have to be, as the laws are today, you have to be declared dead before Alcor can take over.
Oh, okay. Because you said about to die, so just to be clear.
They want to have the people on, you know, the staff ready to go right when the person expires. They want to be there ready to go. Now,
okay.
You know, a big thing that Bob and I talk about all the time, you know, what's the definition of death? When a person dies, they stop breathing, their heart stops, you know, whatever. They've sustained so much damage that they can't, you know, their body won't work anymore for one reason or another. Are they really dead? Is their brain really dead? Is the memories of their memories and their personality and everything still intact in their brain? That's the most important thing, because Alcor, you know, does just neurals as well. They just freeze people's heads as well. And honestly, that's what I'm signed up for, because it's a lot less expensive. And without going into all the rigmarole about how crazy that sounds, I'll just continue to tell you the process. So let's say a person dies, quote unquote dies to meet, you know, what the local hospital says is death. Alcor does those things I described, and they immediately transport you to the Alcor facility, which is in Phoenix, Arizona. They picked Phoenix, Arizona, because it's one of the most stable places as far as, you know, relative temperature. There's not going to be crazy weather happening there. There's not going to be tsunami or anything like that. There's no, you know, there's very little earthquake activity.
Natural disasters.
Once they get you into the Alcor facility, they do a lot of different things, but in essence, they drain your blood and they fill the body with biological antifreeze. And what that does, what these chemicals do, is
cryoprotectants.
The cryoprotectants do is they make it so when the cells in the body freeze that they don't form ice crystals. Because most of the damage done in the freezing process is the rupturing of all the cells. Because, you know, as you know, water requires more space when it's frozen than when it's not frozen. That's really bad, really, really bad. And every single cell in the human body explodes, pretty much, to some degree.
More likely implodes, because it's the ice formation around the cells that impinges on the cells and does damage.
So implodes, explodes, you're fine.
Yeah, so
freezer burn.
So okay. What they found is with the cryoprotectants,
it stings.
With vitrification, the vitrification process, they found that they've dramatically minimized the amount of damage that occurs to during the freezing process. And there's also, you know, how fast do they freeze you, and, you know, there's different stages to this, of course. And most importantly, what effect does it have on the brain? If you liken the brain to, say, let's say that you have a huge jar of sand with all these different colored sands in there, and if you shake it just a little bit, you can still infer where the colors were supposed to be and where they belong. If you shake it too much, which would represent a lot of damage, you're lost. You can't really put things back together the way that they used to. And in order to successfully resuscitate someone that's been frozen, there's other technologies like nanotechnology that's absolutely crucial. But in order to do it, in essence, what they need to do is, at the very least, worst case scenario, they need to infer They need to, the ability to infer where the cells need to go in order to be functional, in order to also contain memories and also to have like your personality and everything intact. A lot of people believe that the current freezing process is at that point where they can infer this data. A lot of people don't believe that. But the freezing process, Alcor's technique, does evolve. You know, and also one of the hopes is one of my hopes is that they're going to be able to get other types of stasis, where warmer temperature stasis, where it doesn't even actually have to be, you know, down to I think they go to -192 right now.
That's cold.
Yeah, that's very cold. Liquid nitrogen.
Have they tested this on animals?
Yeah, yeah, they've actually done a lot of testing on animals, and I remember reading and seeing a lot of stuff on the web about a dog that they froze, and not down to 192, but they did have it below freezing, and bring it back.
I did read that they did vitrify a liver and successfully thaw it out. So
they have done whole organs. However, the couple of the points on the other side is they haven't done the vitrification of a whole mammal or vertebrate.
They have done organs. Right. They have
not
frozen.
Vitrification. And also, the, you know, the vitrification process is not different from what like you would do to preserve an organ for organ transplantation, except that the concentrations of the cryoprotectants are much lower. In organ transplantation, the concentrations used in the vitrification process at Alcor are at toxic levels, and they don't really know what the toxic effect is. They're just hoping that it's not as bad as freezing and crystallization and crystal formation. So it's a trade-off, and they don't really know what they're honest about that at least. So the guy asked, "Is this science?" Well, you know. They're honest about what they're doing. They're doing what they say that they're doing, and they're honest about what we don't know. You know, I'm pretty pessimistic about the possibility of reconstructing meaningful memory connections in the brain.
Why?
after the current state of technology for freezing.
If you did
like just ordinary freezing with crystal formation, I think there's going to be too much destruction to preserve the structures that are necessary. If with the vitrification process, that actually is probably the better way to go now, but there's the huge unknown of what is going to be the toxicity of that dose of cryoprotectant on the brain.
Yeah, but you're clinically dead. I mean, a little more damage. So what? You're at least preserved.
We're going to need very advanced nanotechnology in order to reconstruct people's cellular structures and to get into that detail.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So all of us anyway assumes that at the future end, right, when 100 years from now, 200 years from now, whatever, when they're thawing you out, that they have, you know, super advanced technology, nanotechnology, whatever, that can repair all the damage that's being done. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that, you know, that happens, that there'll be some point in the future where we have enough technology that we can basically reconstruct you and fix all the damage at the cellular level. There's still the ultimate problem of, you know, is that information in your brain preserved or not?
And well, that's the key. That's the key. Without that, this is a waste of time.
Yeah, once the information's gone, there's no technology that can bring it back.
Correct.
If it's truly gone.
Correct,
Steve,
but I've read of studies of frozen and thawed brains, and under a microscope, they looked at the structures that encode, you know, memories, and they said these structures are in good shape. So I think it's reasonable to assume that you can still infer a prior functioning state, and damn, it's worth a shot.
There's nothing impossible about it. That's the huge unknown, though.
So what? The question is, if you're an atheist, you don't believe in God, you're questioning the afterlife, and you want to take a chance, right? You want to say, well, what could I do? This is really the only thing that you can do. It is based on science. There's legitimate science being done. Nobody is saying this is 100% going to work. The technology we have is complete. It isn't. Everybody knows that it isn't. It's just this is the best thing that's happening out there.
And Steve, I don't think it's an unknown. I don't think they're saying, well, you know, the structures that encode memory, they might be totally destroyed or they might be in good shape. No, I think it's generally agreed that these structures are in good shape.
But Bob, it takes such little changes in chemistry or in some sort of physical damage in your brain to have profound effects on your personality and your thought processes.
Yeah, but what's just, brain science? Brain science, as Steve said in the Infidel Guy interview, the past few decades, brain science has improved tremendously. What's it going to be like in 50 or 100 years? I mean, I think we'll have a pretty darn good understanding of brain and mind and personality and brain chemistry to deal with that stuff.
Bob, don't even say we'll have a pretty darn good. I mean, in order for this to work, they're going to have to know the human brain. They're going to have to absolutely know what's going on. You know, it's like this. Imagine explaining to someone 100 years ago that we sent someone to the moon. Like, it's where do you think science and technology
are
going?
I don't disagree. Look, I don't disagree. This is not a crazy thing to do. Okay? This is a gamble. It's reasonable. If you got the money, if you have some little money, this is not an unreasonable gamble. It's not crazy talk. And I believe Steve when he says that, and you, Jay, that Alcor is being upfront and honest about their limitations current. So it's not unreasonable. I wouldn't have any faith in the procedure right now. That's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, I would just caution against underestimating the unknowns in all of this. It doesn't mean that it's not that it can't work or it's not worthwhile. It's still a personal choice if you think that this is what you want to do and this is if it's worth it to you. And again, there is nothing pseudoscientific or supernatural in all of this. It's just, you know, we're speculating about the unknowns. Right.
If you detect any kind of, you know, like I have some value I've put into this, it's in the idea that I want people that I care about, I want people that I love to do this because it is the only way out.
It's not the only way out. I'm still hoping for the upload.
Right.
I actually spoke with another Alcor client recently, and he had something very interesting to say. So here,
we're all gonna die.
No, I'll play that for you now.
Okay. My name's Joe, and I'm a defrosty.
Hello, Joe.
When I was frozen, giant carrots ruled the earth, but now they don't. It takes some getting used to.
So that's Joe the Alcor patient.
Where did you find that? That's awesome.
I know my people in places. I mean, I don't want to divulge all my sources, but
Steve. It's 30 years in the future. You're on your deathbed. There is no uploading option at that point in time. Somebody comes to you and says that we can sign you up right now so that we will freeze you once you are declared legally dead. Would you
and
just
by then
it?
Walmart? Well, you can buy it at Walmart, I'm sure by then.
So Steve, do you say screw you? There's too many unknowns, or
no?
Do you
why
take
not?
A few, I mean,
I'm not
dice?
Saying I'm not saying not do it. Why not? I'd be a cryonic.
It is a
okay.
Why all right.
If it's the grave,
that's
if it's
I
the
wanted.
Grave or cryonics,
that's
then it, that's you know it's not much of a choice. I'd be willing to take that chance to wake up in some fantastic far technological future.
Wake in some post-apocalyptic hell.
That'd be cool.
We've thawed out another one for dinner.
Let's say it's going to take like 200 years to fix whatever the hell you die of. How do I know this company is going to still be around? How do I know they're going to keep those refrigerators running all this time? I mean, it's so out there. It's so incredibly out there.
I mean, they obviously thought of that. They obviously thought of this company has to exist. This company has to make it for a very long time. And part of the money that you give goes into sustaining the company and sustaining
Jay, that's what your money goes to whenever you pay money for anything. The money is going towards sustaining the company. Every company wants to be here 200 years from now, but very few of them are going to make it happen.
It's a good
they
point.
They could shoot you into space and you could remain frozen by the vacuum of space.
That'd be cheaper.
That's definitely one of the risks. It's one of the risks.
Right, I know, and that's what I'm telling you. So when you consider all of these risks, not just the scientific, but the financial, and then you also add in the risk of waking up as a zombie.
Yeah, what happens in a nuclear explosion?
Then you're
effed.
But everyone else,
you're done. Game over.
It's game over when your heart stops. I mean,
when you're saying that you might as well because why not? You're making the same argument that the the con artists make when they tell people, you know, you have cancer, you might as well go try psychic surgery. You've got the thousands of dollars. What would you pay for the chance that it just might work?
I wouldn't equate those chances, though.
You know, yeah. The thing is, though,
one's
is
feasible,
this
the other
is based
is not.
On legitimate science. It's not like this thing started off like chiropractic. Where
I'm not saying that there's
hooey.
Not a glimmer of hope that it
yeah,
might happen.
I don't have a lot of faith in this
point,
either, but...
At this
but Rebecca,
point,
psychic surgery, that's a pretty low blow.
At this yeah. point, no, you are talking about buying a lottery ticket. And yeah. and as we all know, the chances of winning
be
the
in
lottery
it to win
are
it.
Only slightly improved by buying the ticket.
Got to be in it to win it.
Rebecca,
slightly zero
is,
chance compared to 0.00003. That's like what? That's an infinite.
That's infinitely more.
Your chances are only slightly improved by buying the ticket.
Oh, not
that's
true.
What
not
I'm
true.
Saying.
The point is that nobody, good or bad, nobody really knows how well the current preservation process works, right? So they could be underestimating its usefulness or overestimating its usefulness or how effective it is. So right now, you know, you could be making a very good argument saying, well, this, and this point to such a low probability, but the fact is we really don't know.
Well, we have time for one named that logical fallacy. This is an email I got from Matto, M-A-T-O, in Switzerland, and he writes, "Hi, I find your podcast really interesting, and it's interesting to hear the rational, in quotes, minded folks, too. However, I was disappointed with your podcast number 89, where you trash everything that is not right off what the mainstream media is telling you. While you bash these celebrities who speak out for 9/11 investigation, you don't notice that obviously you didn't research history really. It's a proven fact that governments have used false flag operations to get their things through. Hitler did it with the Reichstag fire and blamed it on a communist terrorist, and then used it as a pretext to implement the Enabling Act, which is basically the Patriot Act that Bush Nazi then created with the 9/11 event, and invaded Poland, where Bush then tried to associate 9/11 with Saddam Hussein and Iraq, WMDs. See parallels?
No.
He goes on, but we'll stop there.
You get the full
time. Well, first of all, you've got the Godwin fallacy. He totally Godwined this discussion. Yeah, you know, mentioning Hitler in the first
yes.
30 seconds.
Yes. Hitler's got to have his own fallacy at this point.
Yeah. It's Godwin, yeah. It's called the Godwin yeah. fallacy.
But it's poisoning the well. It's basically, you know, you bring up Hitler's name to sort of broad brush this sort of sinister, you know, whitewash over whatever topic you're talking about, or to associate a person that you wish to trash with, like, the most hated, you know, evil figure in all of human history.
So there's also there's a false analogy there, right?
Yeah, you're right. I agree.
The comparison of Bush to Hitler, and just assuming that we understand the parallels.
Getting into the first paragraph, he also, I'm not sure exactly how to, he basically makes a false statement here, where he says, he accuses us of trashing everything that is not right off what the mainstream media is telling you. So
that's
I guess,
a straw
false,
man.
But yeah, it's a straw man, a false premise. So, of course we don't do that. I mean, we criticize the mainstream media all the time.
It's ridiculous on its face.
And what he's basically saying is that the assumption in that statement is that the positions that we were taking, basically that there is no 9/11 conspiracy, that the standard story is accurate, that we are just getting that unaltered from the mainstream media, believing it wholesale without doing any thought or investigation of our own. So there's kind of like a backdoor sort of implication in that statement, which is absurd. I mean, just, you know, listen to more than 5 minutes of our podcast.
He brings up the Halliburton, you know, connection to Cheney and all that.
Yeah.
You know, that is legitimate. You know, there are definite connections between Bush and Cheney and some of these big companies that you know, have government contracts. And I'm sure that there's behind-the-scenes influences going on left and right. I mean, look at the whole Enron thing.
That fallacy is – that's the where there's smoke, there's fire fallacy. That basically you're saying that because there's been some shady dealing – with, you know, the contracts that have been given in Iraq, or because the Bush administration, you know, may have been motivated to attack Iraq and take Saddam Hussein out beforehand. Let's just assume these are true for the sake of argument, that therefore they perpetrated 9/11 in order to make those things happen. So that's the argument from Final Consequences, this is true because of the consequences that it had.
I'm not saying all I'm saying in that statement is there is some legitimacy, you know, in the idea that sure there's some shifty deals going on. I think a lot of people believe that.
If you have friends in high places, you'll benefit.
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
But that doesn't
but let's
mean,
put that but Jay,
I know, wait,
let's
Steve,
put
I'm
that
not,
in
I'm
context.
Not going there. I'm not going.
I know that, but let's keep it in the context of what he's saying. He's saying that these things add up to Bush and the Bush administration carried out 9/11 and they're covering it up with a big conspiracy.
Yeah. And 20,000 people are keeping their mouths shut. Mm-hmm.
Right. So the other false analogy here is to the Reichstag fire, that one guy could have set fire to that building. You know, it could have been Hitler and some other guy. So he said, you know, hey, Franz, burn the building. You know, it literally could have been two guys. Maybe it was five guys.
It caught
his
fire.
Whatever. But pulling that off is not analogous to pulling off 9/11 as a conspiracy, which would have required an incredible amount of planning, an incredible amount of coordination between hundreds or thousands of people. There would have been a 100 or 1,000 ways in which the conspiracy could have collapsed, or people could have ended up with smoking gun evidence of it. The same is not true of the Reichstag fire. In fact, there is no historical analogy to any government or any organization pulling off anything even close to 9/11.
As far as you know.
It's not as if the Bush administration has demonstrated, you know, incredible competence and subtlety in pulling off masterful, complicated plans. I mean, what's this guy talking about?
And he was only in office 9 months.
Yeah, he was only in office 9 months. He would have had to plan this whole thing in nine months.
Don't make me go into the Bush connection with the Saudis and the I didn't. Come on, that family's been evil for decades. Please. Thank you.
Just waiting to gain the power in order to destroy the U.S.
If
economy.
I was Bush and I masterminded this whole conspiracy, the moment that I was told about the 9/11 crashes, I wouldn't like be reading kids a children's book, and have that dumb expression on my face when I heard the news. I would have planned that moment. I would have been like doing something so cool, and when they told me, I would have looked in the camera and looked like James Bond, you know? It certainly wouldn't have been like when they told him. He was like, "What?"
You know, like the president was lifting weights when he heard the news.
Well, yeah, right.
He dashed to his Lamborghini and took off for the White House.
I'll get right
down
on
the pole,
you
know, to the Batcave.
Cool. It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week's challenge?
Yes.
Challenge accepted.
All right. Number 1. China claims it will use weather control to ensure sunny days for its 2008 Olympic Games. Item number 2, researchers have discovered that by compressing water at the nanoscale, it will behave as if it were metal. Item number 3, scientists have discovered a giant fossilized rainforest as big as a city in the middle of Illinois. Rebecca, go first.
Oh, man. A fossilized rainforest in Illinois. I like the sound of that. That sounds really cool, actually. What would that look like? Sorry. Okay.
Hello, Bob. Is this Bob?
I know. I'm doing the Bob thing.
Get on with it.
It's called the Bob.
And China is, they're nuts. So they would definitely try to create some sort of evil weather controlling doomsday device. Compressing water in the, that sounds fishy. I'm going to go with that one.
Okay, Bob.
2.
Is compressing water?
Tell me how you phrase it again, Steve. Read number 2, please.
Researchers have discovered that by compressing water at the nanoscale, it will behave as if it were metal.
That's a fiction.
Okay. Evan?
Nano fiction.
Jay?
Obviously the water.
Wow.
Perry?
See, everybody follows me.
Yes, I believe that China will control the weather. Doesn't cooperate, they'll have it shot. A rainforest as big as the city? Sure, nothing wrong with that. Number 2 has the word nano in it, so that's probably fake.
Okay. So you all agree that China's going to control the weather for the 2008 Olympic Games.
Everybody read that.
Yes.
You guys?
Well, that's what they claim.
I didn't read nothing. I didn't read that. How the hell are they going to make it sunny?
And that is, in fact, science.
I actually read...
At least it's true that they're claiming... The claim is
they're
right,
seeding
whether or
the
not
clouds. They're using that.
Wait, that's
that
to
same
make
technique.
It rain.
Yes. So what they're going to, what they plan on doing is using the cloud seeding technique in order to make it rain before the Olympic Games, so that it will clean out the clouds and the atmosphere, so there'll be nothing left to
and
rain
the pollution
during the Olympic Games.
It's like giving the animals hermetics so that they dump before they're on parade. I get it.
It's a beautiful
and they'll pray to Buddha
analogy.
So that's their plan. Now, the technology is controversial. In 2003, the National Academy of Sciences questioned the science behind cloud seeding as too weak. But they say, but China claims that they frequently use the artificial rainmaking technique in drought in the drought-plagued north.
The high jump was called off today when a sudden rain of seeds pelted the stadium, forcing everyone into the streets. Sorry.
So they used little packets of silver iodide in the clouds to force them, to provoke them to rain, basically.
Little packets.
So, well, see how that works
I wonder if
out.
It looks like Sweet and Low. That's a great picture. Sorry. Go on.
You guys also all agree that scientists have discovered a giant fossilized rainforest as big as a city in the middle of Illinois.
Sure.
And that is science.
Yeah. I'm picturing something out of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Am I the only one that read the news this week? You guys didn't read about this stuff?
I read about it. Well, I read about it. That's why we didn't pick it.
I read about it. I just didn't want to sound snooty.
We didn't want to make
this is really cool.
Bad.
It was found in a coal mine. It's found actually in a coal mine. What's cool about this is that it's a whole forest. You know, so they could actually like have a peek into an actual ecosystem. You know, not just
did you say
thing.
It was in a coal mine?
It was 300 million years old, Steve.
They haven't found many animals, many animal remains, though.
It's a 300 million year old forest that bears little resemblance to most wooded areas
so
today.
So they're down in
as
a coal mine, digging coal, and some guy says, hey, look, a petrified forest.
Yeah, they found a frozen guy down
basically.
There, too.
What?
He got up and he started singing show tunes. It was amazing.
I don't understand your nerd reference.
What?
Which means that researchers have discovered that by compressing water at the nanoscale, it will behave as if it were metal is fiction.
Now, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but you can't compress water.
Well, in fact, this is based on a real study.
Mm-hmm. Molasses, not metal.
It's molasses, not metal, Bob's right. So it does, you can compress it at the nanoscale, and when you do that, it flows much more viscously, and they're comparing it to molasses. Oh. It does not get to the actual, you know, physical properties of metal.
I didn't think you could compress water.
Well, I guess at the nanoscale.
We're talking nano. Anything is possible.
It's more confined than real. I'm not really sure how much it gets compressed.
It's like the new quantum mechanics.
That's right.
Quantum nano.
Nano.
God.
Steve, I'm surprised you didn't go with this story, the quantum mechanics story, about how certain experiments are now showing that reality isn't as real as we thought it was.
Wait, are we all connected to computers?
You guys are...
Well, that's it. Throw physics out.
Are getting harder and harder. This is the second week that you've swept me.
Well, you started with Rebecca and Bob.
Well, I went in reverse order of
yeah, I have to agree with Rebecca.
I mix it up.
One.
I mix it up.
Yeah. We are the ones who actually read the news.
Jay's been doing better with that. He's been reading the news
feverishly.
Good.
I know, you guys are like sending me, you know, links to all the stuff I would have used in science or fiction.
What?
I know, it's true.
We are?
Yeah, well, sure. Bob, we send Steve all the good news items we read.
No, it's getting harder and harder to find things that are cool but obscure that you guys wouldn't have seen. But you know, this is for the audience, not so much you guys. But you guys are getting better. You guys are getting better at science or fiction.
We're gonna have to start throwing games just to make Steve feel better.
Nah. No, well, I don't know, Steve. I guess kittens have five legs now.
I'll go with that one.
Now, Evan, last week's puzzle was an audio puzzle. I don't think we need to play it again.
Just give us the
gist.
I don't think so. It was answered pretty quickly, and they got it right. It was, in fact, a recording by our old friend Dennis Lee of Perpetual Motion fame and Free Energy Machines, and he's been trolling around the United States for the past 20 or 25 years, promising all these miraculous machines that do all kinds of things, and he's never produced a single one of them. And
yeah.
what he apparently is doing now is, if you go to his website, and he has a number that you call, and you can get a monthly or bi-monthly or whatever update from him, and he records a message. And that's where I clipped this particular recording from. It is a 12.5-minute rambling message that he leaves. And maybe what I'll do is I'll send it to Mike at the SGU fan site so that he could put it up for people to hear in case they have 12 minutes of their life they want to waste to hear this guy drone on about exactly what is he selling. He never even says.
He doesn't really sell anything. He's just asking you to invest in the future potential of his amazing technology.
I was actually joking about Evan's ability to sell the clip.
Right. He didn't hear you, Rebecca.
So what is it, though? I mean, what's in a nutshell, what's this guy squawking about?
He's talking about his free energy machines that he's just on the cusp of completing.
Yeah, he's always been just on the cusp.
He just needs a few more people to
invest. Is what he does. He gets 20 or 30 people in a room, and then he barks at them for 2, 3, 4 hours. And most people leave throughout the show until he's got like 4 or 5 people left, the real diehards. And then that's when he hits them up for the real hard sell. His show is a combination of American patriotism, of religion, and newfangled technology. And he sort of treats people to this really rapid-fire demonstration of 20, 30 different technologies that he's working on so that you're left with the sense, well, gee, if just one of these things hits, we'll be millionaires, you know? Just one of these things has to hit. So, but of course, you have to think that he has the slightest bit of sincerity in any of this. Now, Dennis Lee does have a criminal past, if you will. He was arrested 8 times between 74 and 79 New Jersey on fraud, forgery, and drug-related charges. Mm. In 75, he pled guilty in Bergen County, New Jersey to 5 counts of passing bad checks and to taking money under false pretenses.
I'm shocked.
He was given a year suspended sentence and a 3 years probation. In 78, he convinced Pat Robertson to give him $150,000. 2 months later, Robertson accused Lee of false advertising, operating a pyramid sales scheme, and unauthorized sales of securities. And Robertson never got his money back. Hmm. Boo-hoo. He was arrested in 82 for passing bad checks. He was accused by Washington State Attorney General in 1985 civil action of violating the State Consumer Protection Act. And the list goes on. So the guy has a very dubious history. He's basically convicted of fraud. Of course, that doesn't mean that he's necessarily lying now, but it's a pretty good
bet. Fred, I and a couple of friends once went and protested him at a local hotel around here. We're standing in the lobby handing out flyers to the poor suckers that were going to his demonstration, delineating some of the things.
Hundreds of people turned out to see this.
Yeah. Were you there, right, Evan?
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, we did it for, 20 minutes or so, and then some of his people came up, harassed us a little. They went and got security, and, we didn't have a room at the hotel, so we had to leave. We tried to hand some out in the parking lot, but...
Yeah,
we got quite a few flyers out in that time, though. We did. I'm sure they were circling around the audience.
If we saved just one person,
from investing
their, now, their life, well, this their life savings,
the skeptics have been dogging Lee. You know, we actually made a lot of the local skeptical groups got together, and again, over email. And we had a schedule of where he was going, and we basically dogged him all the way around the country trying to inform the public not to to buy into his schemes. Evan, did you tell me who the first person was to get that right?
Ole Ivind from the message boards. So congratulations, Ole.
And what's the puzzle for this week?
Okay, here we go. It offers plenty of traction, yet barely moves at all. It offers a rosy view, yet may damage your sight. It offers a contrast in style, but don't let your head swell. You'll find your pockets may empty in more ways than one. What is it that I'm describing? Good luck, everyone.
Well, thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Bob, you have a quote to close out the show for us?
Yeah, I've got a quote from Bart Costco, author of Fuzzy Thinking and the New Science of Fuzzy Logic. I read this years ago, and this quote, I had never forgot this quote. He said, "Death is an engineering problem."
That's an awesome quote.
I guess that's appropriate.
Good quote, Bob.
Well, everyone, thanks again for joining me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve, thank you so much.
Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.